Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guests are Pulitzer Prize winning historian Joseph Ellis and the Emmy Award winning film producer and director of Surviving Ohio State, Eva Orner. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Even more importantly, we want you to vote on the worst of the worst of Trump appointees. We have a voting page ready to log your opinion in the show notes for this episode, so make your voice heard. As they say in Chicago, vote early and vote often. Then we'll announce them in an upcoming show. Let's just say they put the Ivy League sphincters contest to shame, so please make your voice heard. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the link to our sponsor, Fay Nutrition, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. James, Congress is on the verge of passing a humongous spending and tax bill that will, just to go over the highlights, take from the poor and the working class and give to the rich. Let me make sure everyone heard that right. It takes from the poor and working class and gives to the rich. That's not just something from know-nothing journalists or left-wing politicians. That's what the Congressional Budget Office concluded, the Penn Wharton model, the Tax Policy Center. You know, earlier conservative bills would sometimes give crumbs to the working poor and a lot more to the rich. This one doesn't even go through the motions of doing that. They take from the working poor and even some middle class. And, you know, billionaires can rejoice in this bill while it's taking health care coverage from more than 11 million Americans. Millions more will lose food stamps, including veterans, because of new bureaucratic rules. And as a result of this bill, child poverty and hunger are going to soar, and without health care, some people are going to die. The legislation would add about $4 trillion to the deficit. But Lindsey Graham and his merry band of fraudsters devised a new gimmick. The tax cuts expiring this year will be extended at no cost. It doesn't add to the deficit, Graham would have you believe, because they were there before. So, James, if you have a regular utility bill or any regular bill, guess what? It's going to be free forever. Now, you know, it might not show that effect in your bank account, but it's a free lunch. The overarching realities of this bill, it is radically anti-populist. So the next time you hear Trump or someone like Josh Hawley say, we're populist Republicans, this is the bill that proves whether they are or not. And it's just crap to say that they are. Populists don't give big tax cuts to billionaires while cutting Medicaid and other measures. And secondly, it's just a thoroughly dishonest bill. Other than that, James, it's just awful.
Well, there's one other word you can use to describe it, and that is unpopular. It's literally 25 points underwater, and it's got further to go down. So it's anything that can be done to stretch us out or have more people find out about it, the better off we're going to be. Because the more people know, the more they hate this bill. Even the people that don't know very much don't like it. This is a golden strategic opportunity for the Democrats in Congress. I mean, utterly golden. There's never been a more unpopular bill of this nature that's ever passed the Congress. Not the Clinton stuff, not the Obama stuff, not the Reagan stuff, not any of it, not close. This is the most unpopular in history. So exploit it and use it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Look, the Republicans' hope or strategy here is threefold. Number one, lie. They're not going to get away with that because it is such a blatant lie. I mean, you can't say that we're going to cut $1 trillion in Medicaid, but you know what? They're not going to hurt anybody. I mean, nobody's going to believe that. They won't believe the Lindsey Graham crap about the budget. The second is it won't take effect, some of this, until after the midterms. But you know what? It's not just a threat. There's a reality to talk about and hanging out there for Democrats. The third thing they're counting on, and it's the one thing that, you know, I think I fear a little bit, is distractions, that they're going to get Democrats to focus on other issues, from trans athletes to alligator prisons or migrants. This is, you know, it's not the only thing you talk about, but 80% of the time, a Democrat in a competitive race ought to talk about this bill because there's so much to talk about.
Oh, for God's sakes, please. I mean, I know there are plenty of other things, but you don't want to get distracted. We got an issue that hugely works in our favor. Just strap it on your opponent. Say if the Democrats win the House and the Senate back, they're going to just pass votes every day, repealing the more horrific parts of this, and particularly with reference to veterans' health care, veterans, any kind of veterans' care, rural health care, small-town health care, agriculture, you name it. I guess go through, be nauseating, but don't get out of this. There's a clear contrast. They all voted for it. All the Democrats voted against it. Just keep ramming it home, people. Just keep ramming it home.
It's there. I want a word about Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who provided the winning vote on this. She carved out special provisions for her home state on Medicaid and food stamps. Fair enough. That's what legislators do. But she then voted for what she said was a bad bill that's going to hurt people because she got her parochial favors. Now, rural hospitals, as you note, are going to get clobbered by the Medicaid cuts. So Murkowski and Republicans created a 10-year, $50 billion fund for these hospitals. Okay, that's better. The problem is the bill's going to cost these hospitals an estimated $119 billion. So with a great Murkowski effort, that saves 40% of the rural hospitals that might close. The second point I'd make is, James, the Republicans say, well, we're not cutting Medicaid or food stamps. We're putting in a work requirement. You know, that sounds good to some people. It's been tried. It's been tried in Arkansas and Georgia. And let me tell you why it fails. What it ends up being is a paperwork requirement, a bureaucracy requirement. It ends up that a lot of people do go off the rolls because they are swamped by paperwork trying to prove they tried to get a job where none exists. They're filling out forms after forms after forms. And deserving people lose their Medicaid coverage. So this is the worst thing that's happened since Medicaid was enacted some 60 years ago. And it's an issue that you can hammer home on day after day.
I don't even know what's the definition of work. I mean, what person work or doesn't work? Of course, I assume you take care of child, that's work, or you take care of patient family member. That's work. In the idea that there's a bunch of 29-year-old people that are sucking the Medicaid tip for everything it's worth makes utterly no sense at all. Assume that you're 29. Assume that you choose not to work, that you're whatever their image of you is. You're like a petty thief of whatever. You're not going to sign up for health care. You're going down and fill out 40 pages of crap to get Medicaid because you think you're going to live forever. You're 29 years old. I don't even know what they're trying to do. I really don't. It just, other than just have a talking point, is, well, we're not cutting it for people who work. We're just cutting it for people who don't work. Who works and who doesn't work? I have no idea.
The idea, just look at the overview. A $1 trillion cut in Medicaid, and guess what? Not going to hurt anybody. I mean, that's just on the face of it. It is absurd. It is a lie. And that's what they're doing. And on the food stamps, which aren't as popular, but, you know, people rely on them and they aren't unpopular, as a matter of fact, they're putting the same kind of work requirements in, including there was an exemption earlier for veterans, some of whom suffer from traumatic stress syndrome. They've taken that away. So veterans are going to lose their food stamps, as well as cuts to the VA. James, I think the hardest thing to do, if you were advising a great candidate and that candidate said, James, I agree with you. That bill is a prescription for a disaster for Republicans and great for me. Give me the 3 or 4 points I want to stress. You'd have to work hard because there are 8 or 10 points you want to stress.
So let's back up. Let's talk about just the veterans aspect of this. Now, 17.6 veterans a day did commit suicide. Okay, when you're a week away from suicide, you're thinking about something else other than working. I promise you. You got bad, there are bad things going on in your brain. It's all so inhumane. It's all so stupid. It all such makes no sense at all. But again, I keep coming back. The most encouraging thing is the public, they may not know everything's in it. We don't know everything's in it because we keep finding out shit that's in there. It's 1,000 pages long. And we keep finding out, but we're starting a good place on this. The public hates it to start, and they're going to hate it more as we go forward.
And they are. And every day you fall in the Trump's trap of talking a lot about other things is a day that you lose this opportunity because it is there. And you know that's what he'll do because, I mean, they see the same polls that you and I see. They know it's unpopular. So they do. They have to lie about it, and they have to distract rather. And that's I think he is the worst president of my lifetime, but he is pretty good at that. He knows how to distract.
Lifetime? Shit, how old are you? 250 years old?
I mean, ask Joe Ellis about that.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. But just stay. This is golden. You just need this. You don't need anything else to speak of.
Yeah. And he told them he wanted it on his desk by July 4. Now, you know, there is such a thing as the legislative process. I mean, it does have some merit. There are committee hearings. There are witnesses. There are analysts who come in for and against the bill. They just said bag all that. They really did. It was just, it was sloppy. It was dishonest in many ways. I can't get over Lindsey Graham saying, guess what? $3.8 trillion of tax cuts will cost nothing. We'll see how the bond markets react to that, James.
Well, I mean, first of all, the currency market are reacting. The dollar's at an all-time low. This is the worst 6 months the dollar's had with any president. So you can start there. But just stay, you know, I hate to be like a one-trick pony here, but just stay on this. This has changed. They want to get this rotting fish out quickly. And they think that when they pass it and he signs it, everybody's going to forget about it and move on, and no such thing shall happen, and we should not let them forget about it. How many votes, idiotic votes, they took to repeal Obamacare, which is popular, okay? This is unpopular. So we'll take as many votes to repeal this as you took to repeal Obamacare. How does that work out for you? Because you know what they're going to say. Oh, they're just wasting their time. They need to be constructive and work with this president. They're living in the past. They're doing this. They're doing that. Okay, fine. You took 139 votes to repeal Obamacare. We're going to take 138 to repeal this.
Well, James, you just reminded me of something else that we hadn't mentioned. This bill cuts back on the Affordable Health Care Act, which, as you say, is popular. And what it really does, it goes after those states that have expanded Medicaid because of the Affordable Health Care Act. Now, that's 41 states, 7 red states. I mean, real conservative states, the Oklahomas, I think Nebraskas, the South Dakotas, voted to expand Medicaid by referendum. And these people say, you know, we hate the ACA, we hate Obamacare, so we're going to sneak something in that basically screws those states. It really is the most dishonest piece of legislation I have ever seen.
By far. And again, it's horribly dishonest. The whole premise of it, that it doesn't cost anything because you extend something, is utterly ludicrous. People know that. And people are, by large numbers, predisposed to think this is a bad piece of legislation, let's just keep reminding them.
Absolutely, and keep reminding them of their falsehood. Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, who's supposed to be among the least dangerous, shall we say, in this administration, goes on Bloomberg television and says this is an important step to reducing the deficit. To what? Reducing the deficit? It adds $4 trillion to the deficit. And I don't think, he thinks people are idiots and they won't realize this. I'll tell you, Mr. Secretary, people are not that dumb.
No, I don't think they are. And I think he did that to, you know, to please Trump. But I don't know what the guy is thinking. But they're not going to convince anybody of this. You just got to keep it going. Just make this fish rot, rot, stink, stink, rot, rot. Don't say, oh, we pointed all that out. Let's go to the next thing. No. Keep talking about this dead fish. Don't let them get rid of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we've covered this. I mean, I think it's been a good discussion, and I don't think there's anything we've missed. Do you, James?
I don't think so. I think this does give, this is a real gift because it gives everybody in the whole Trump opposition, the Democratic Party, something clear and decisive to rally around. And we should use this and exploit this opportunity between now and Election Day. And I think this is going to, to the extent that the Republicans be hurt any more in Virginia, I think it's going to hurt them even more. And I think it's going to hurt them more in New Jersey. It's going to hurt, like hell. This is not popular.
Absolutely. Okay. You hear it out there, voters.
It's invaluable. And if you had a way that would be affordable and you would have the advice right in front of you, it would be unbelievable. And I think these people have figured that out. Bingo, you got it.
Forget fads. Your diet affects your energy levels, your mood, your sleep, and long-term health. That's why Fae Nutrition is so great. Fae connects you directly with registered dietitians, real food and nutrition experts, for personalized nutrition counseling tailored specifically to you. The best part is that all their dietitians take insurance, so 95% of people pay zero for their sessions. That's right, zero. This podcast is sponsored by Fae, because Fae matches you one-on-one with a dedicated dietitian who will help you understand your body's unique needs. Together, you'll create a sustainable, evidence-based program, not just a quick fix, to help you build healthy habits and achieve your health goals. Now that we found out that insurance can get you the dietary guidance you need, none of us has an excuse. Forget one-size-fits-all diet plans. Fae creates a customized program tailored specifically to you, and whether you're trying to lose weight, dealing with low energy, digestive discomfort, navigating food allergies, managing conditions like PCOS or diabetes, you just want clarity and all the confusing diet noise. Personalized guidance from Fae could be the exact foundational support that you need. They believe expert nutrition counseling should be accessible to everyone and make it simple to find a dietitian to fit your needs and instantly check your insurance coverage before signing up. Now, like we said, the vast majority of people pay zero, that's as in nothing, for their sessions. I know for a fact that we all find any excuse we can to avoid spending cash, particularly as we get older. But James and I realize it's finally time to handle our health with Fae. Having a personalized nutritionist used to cost the big bucks. Not anymore. Thanks to Fae, right now, listeners of Politics War Room can qualify to see a registered dietitian for as little as zero. That's $0. By visiting FaeNutrition.com/War Room. That's FaeNutrition.com/War Room. One last time, that's FaeNutrition.com/War Room. Make sure you use the URL so they know we sent you. The link is in our show notes.
Eat right your way with Fae Nutrition.
Our guest is Eva Orner, who directed Surviving Ohio State, an extraordinary documentary on a two-decade-long sex scandal where the team doctor, Richard Strauss, sexually abused hundreds of athletes, even raping dozens. Especially victimized was the wrestling team. Strauss would shower with the athletes, sometimes masturbating while he was doing it. If they came in for an ear or a shoulder problem, he would massage their genitals. There have been other sex abuse scandals at Penn State and Michigan State, among others, but university presidents and top coaches were fired. There was accountability. By contrast, Ohio State covered up these crimes, and no one has really paid any price except those young athletes. Eva, it is amazing. How did Ohio State get away with this?
It's a really good question. God, you start with hard questions. I mean, I think they got away with it for so long because it happened during the 70s to the 90s, and it was a time when people didn't talk about this. I think the survivors, I prefer to call them survivors than victims, but the survivors were predominantly, you know, Midwestern, innocent, pretty young, sexually inexperienced. There was no internet. You couldn't Google what is a hernia check. You couldn't check anything. There was no one to talk to. It wasn't like you went and made, you know, there was an HR department and you were told about to look out for grooming or molestation. So I think there was an element of the kids, they were kids at the time, not knowing what was happening to them. There was also, I think, shame, embarrassment, you know, homophobia. If you said something had happened to you, you know, you'd be called like a, you know, you know, you'd be labeled as like, you know, being gay or something, which at the time was really terrible. I think there's a whole combination of reasons. But when people did complain, Ohio State did nothing. And that's very documented in the film. You know, people knew and they didn't do anything.
No, it sure is. And these former wrestlers like Nick DiSabato, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, whose family is wrestling royalty,
yes,
at Ohio State, they opened up to you about these painful, humiliating experiences. That took real courage.
I always come back to this when I talk about the film. I spoke to probably 100 survivors. Roughly 100 survivors, most of them, and I completely understand and respect, they do not want to go public, they do not want to be on camera. It's a really tough thing to do. And so the survivors that are in the film are incredibly brave. Their families support them and are brave. They live in, you know, small communities that are sports crazy, that are, you know, the Buckeyes are like almost like a cult, you know. It's very hard to go against them in Columbus, especially. So the guys are super brave. And I think what's really interesting is, you know, they came out 7 years ago in 2018, inspired by the Larry Nassar story and the survivors speaking out. But they got the absolute opposite reaction. They were vilified. They were not believed. People had that sort of very typical male response of, if it was me, I would have beat the shit out of Strauss. And so they weren't heard. And what's really changed is, and also OSU have fought them tooth and nail for 7 years in the courts. And what's really changed since the film came out is they have been heard, and there's such a difference in them. I've been, you know, talking with them and being part of their lives for 3.5 years making this, and they are very different now. They needed to be heard and respected. And all of us, we're on a group chat together. There's 10 of them, and all of us they're all posting, they're getting texts and messages and social media messages from strangers or ex-colleagues or students saying, you are brave, you're amazing, you know, what you've done is incredible. And we're all sharing them, and I think it's really, really helping them all because that's what they needed. And it's been a real surprise to me how positively it's been received and how it's changed them.
I have written columns on this, and James and I have focused on it in this podcast, particularly on the assistant wrestling coach during these sexual crimes, and now a powerful member of Congress, Jim Jordan. He claims he never knew anything about this. There was this massive sexual abuse going on in the showers, the locker rooms. Jim Jordan, I didn't know anything, but you had a number of those wrestlers and a former referee who said Jim Jordan knew everything about this, right?
Yeah, look, I think when the guys came out in 2017, they thought people would believe them because that's what we do. We believe survivors of sexual abuse and sexual assault, but they weren't. And then they thought, okay, if anyone's going to help us, it's going to be the two people that we looked up to as Jim as a brother, Russ Hellickson as a father figure, who were the coach and the assistant coach for a period of time at OSU. And both of them have not only let the guys down, I mean, Russ went quiet and Jim Jordan has said he didn't know anything. And I think I really wanted to show in the film the extent to which Ohio State knew at the time, how many reports were made, how many people knew, how many horrible decisions were made by people at OSU. And I think when Jim Jordan says on camera repeatedly, "I did not know anything," obviously we have a lot of people saying he knew, "I told him." But to me, the most damning thing in a way is that Charlotte Remniak, who was the fencing coach, she knew and she complained. And she was a woman and she was not in the locker room. And a lot of this happened and was talked about in the locker room. And Jim Jordan was in the locker rooms, and he's, you know, if he had a locker in the wrestling room and Dr. Strauss was having showers all the time with the athletes and he didn't see it, that's very hard to believe or understand.
Well, it's impossible to believe. And DeSabato said, again, he's just showing nothing but courage, no reason not to tell the truth. He said Jordan tried to get him to change his story and even cried and begged. And one of the referees, who says Strauss made a play for him in the shower, went and told Jordan about it, who just shrugged it off and said, "Well, that's just Strauss."
Yes.
I mean, there is no doubt he knew, I think, and he has paid no price. He lies. He was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he's lying about covering up a crime, which I believe is a crime itself.
I would agree with you, and I would say, unfortunately, now there is no surprise in politicians lying. It's become the norm, and it's shocking and abhorrent. And I think the film is pretty rock solid in showing that he lied. And obviously, Adam DeSabato, you know, testified before Congress about this, about Jim Jordan calling him and crying and saying, "You need to change your story. You've got to support me." And I think that's a big moment. But also, Fred Feeney, who was a wrestling referee, his story is really important because he wasn't 18 or 20 at the time and powerless and dependent on Dr. Strauss to pass him physically so he could compete. Fred Feeney was 40 years old at the time and he was abused by Dr. Strauss and he felt powerless like a lot of victims of sexual abuse, and he didn't do anything and he was ashamed and he was shocked. But he did walk out and he did say to Russ and to Russ Hellickson and Jim Jordan what happened to him. And he says very firmly that Jim Jordan said, "Oh, that's just Strauss." So there's time after time after time where we show that Jim Jordan knew. And for him to, A, he has said nothing since the film came out. His communications person released another statement saying he didn't know anything. I reached out to get an interview and they did not do an interview. And I think that they are just saying nothing in the hope that this will blow away and, you know, disappear. But if you look at social media, which I always think is an interesting gauge, the conversation about this film, I'd say 80 or 90% of the comments are about Jim Jordan.
Yeah. James.
So obviously the victims of this unspeakable act were males. Would it have been a different result had there been females? I mean, is it a little bit like, "Oh, suck it up, shit, man, you're 18 years old, what are you talking about?" Do you have a sense of that?
I think that's one of the really big problems. We talk about that a lot in the film. If it's, and we actually use footage of the survivors of Larry Nassar, because when you see them standing up in court and testifying, it's very easy to understand what happened to them. When you look at someone like Mark Coleman, who's a big WWF fighter, all these guys are big and now they're in their 40s and 50s. I think it's a real stretch to understand why it happened. And we talk about it a lot in the film, the inability for them to communicate what was happening to them, the shame, the embarrassment. And also that they were dependent on their scholarships. I mean, if they spoke out or if they didn't have a medical exam, they weren't cleared to play. And what's really telling is that this scandal kind of broke when it was a non-athlete student who made the complaint. That's when it really started, because he had nothing to lose. You know, Steve Snyder-Hill, he wasn't an athlete. So the athletes had everything to lose. And the really heartbreaking part is a lot of them dropped out of college. I've spoken to so many who dropped out of college and they never talked about why. They never told their parents why. Al Nawakowski, who's in the film, would have gone on to be a pro hockey player. He never graduated. He dropped out. He never played hockey again. He would have been a very successful athlete. Dan Ritchie dropped out of college and he never told his father why, because again, 20, 30 years ago, you couldn't talk about this kind of subject. So the fact that they are men has been a huge difference in this story, and it's made the general public until now, I think, not believe them to a degree. But I think the film is, we were very, very careful to make sure that there were so many people saying the same thing independently that it's pretty rock solid. I don't see any audience members watching this film and saying, I don't believe these men. It's absolutely heartbreaking what happened to them.
There's a behemoth at the center of all this, and it's known as the Ohio State University, which is a very large, and I can assure you, very powerful institution. Did the Ohio State University do anything to try to find out about this? Say, was there an investigative report they got or anything along those lines?
So, you know, we talk about in the film that complaints were made between the mid-70s and the mid-90s when this happened, but nothing was done. There was no follow-up. And then nothing really happened. He wasn't even fired. He left the school. He left the school with emeritus status, even though they knew he had done things. And years went by, and it wasn't until 2018 when Mike DeSabato first came out with this story. And OSU initially did what universities should do in this situation, and they did a very expensive independent investigation through the law firm, strangely, Perkins Coie, who have been under attack from Donald Trump. And no one expected the report, the independent investigation into the Strauss abuse. The report was much worse than anyone thought, and we use it a lot in the film. And initially it was a few hundred victims were identified, and there was, I think, 37 instances of rape. It was terrible. But what came out after the guys went public and after some time had elapsed is we now know there are over 2,000 victims and 271 rapes that we know
about. Oh, my God.
And I've spoken to many survivors who are not part of the lawsuit, who have never come out publicly, and who never will because of the shame, and their families don't want them to. So there are more. It is so huge, the scale of this. And over 200 men have still not settled. And OSU are really tricky, and I have to be careful when I talk about this, but they constantly release a statement saying, we are not the same school, we have changed, we initiated the independent investigation. But they initiated it after the guys came out, right? So that, right. That's one thing.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh in the middle of the explanation, but I had to laugh.
So that's one thing they do. And then they say, we have offered, you know, really generous settlements to the guys, and some of them have accepted them. But what they don't say, and what we talk about in the film, is there are problems with the settlements. So the settlements are paltry in comparison to Penn State and Michigan State, which averaged $1 to $1.5 million per survivor. They're offering on average $250,000. And what you can deduce from that is that they're saying, you know, male survivors are worth less than female survivors, possibly. And that's one of the problems. The other problem is they refuse to admit liability in the settlements that the survivors would have to sign. And this is the worst part. Some of the settlements were demanding the survivors could never publicly criticize OSU. So, of course, a lot of people have not signed the settlements and they never talk about that. And that's something I really want to get out there, because I think the implication that they make is that these guys are being difficult. They don't want to sign these generous settlements. But these settlements are not generous. People's lives were destroyed.
Yeah, I just make so people understand, the Ohio State University's athletic department is second only to the University of Texas in total revenue. It is a behemoth. It is powerful. It is wealthy. And it frankly didn't do anything.
Yeah. You know, we talk about their figures. Since 2018, when the guys first came out with these claims, the athletic department at OSU has made over $1.2 billion in revenue. There are about 250 men who have not yet settled. You know, you can do the math. If they were all offered $1 or $1.5 million, it wouldn't make any difference to Ohio State. So the big question is why won't they settle this generously and in the way that men deserve, and in comparison with other situations like this? And if they did, we would not be talking about it. This film would not have been made. Don Wertheim would not have written the article for Sports Illustrated, which started this whole process. And yet they've still given no indication that they want to do that. So since the day after the film came out, they were back in court. So there was Colleen Marshall told me this, who is the journalist who's in the film, who's covered it locally a lot. Because the other thing about this story is it hasn't gotten big national attention, which is, again, right. I think because it's men and it's difficult for people to understand. And Colleen told me that the district court judge is ordering them into mediation. And she's an attorney, so she knows about this situation. And she said, but I was in court yesterday, this is the day after the film came out, and neither side seemed to expect resolution anytime soon. So the other thing that's really heartbreaking is this has been going on for 7 years for these men. They've had 7 years of being ridiculed, embarrassed, not listened to. That's, I think, changed because of the film, which is great. The court case isn't scheduled yet. It'll be 2026 or 2027. So this is going to drag on potentially for another few years. And it's really painful for them. And again, I just say, why can't this university do the right thing? Honor these men.
And I'm sorry. I follow college sports too much.
Yeah. But they won't do it while other schools have done it.
Well, congratulations on a really important film, and it is the oldest dynamic in the world. It's power and evil versus victims and, you know, scared young men. I mean, that you know, anytime you can illuminate that. Albert, go ahead.
Yeah, Ava, you talk about the other at Penn State and Michigan State, which was awful. I'm not sure it was as bad as Ohio State. The university presidents were fired. The athletic directors were fired. Joe Paterno, the legendary coach, was fired. No one, to my knowledge, at Ohio State has been fired. Is that a fair assessment?
The tricky thing is that this didn't come out till years later. You know, this stopped happening in the mid-90s. Strauss left the college in the mid-90s. And at the time, they didn't, you know, it wasn't acknowledged when he was still there. And now it's like 30 years late, 25 years later. So that's the other thing that's happened is I think time has made a difference here. But there hasn't been a lot of repercussions for a lot of people. There's one doctor who was disbarred because of this from the medical board. But
right, on a separate line or something. But, you know, you mentioned the Perkins Coie, and it did lay out a number of the offenses, but I thought I was disappointed when I read about it because it didn't name names. I think in that sense it went in the tank to Ohio State. Jim Jordan claimed that report vindicated him. Why did that law firm have to cop out like that?
I don't know exactly, but you know, in that report it does say that many coaches knew. And Jim Jordan right. routinely says, we have him in the film saying it's an old clip where he says, no, coaches didn't know. So there's also just a lot of, you know, people lie now. Fake news is a thing. The problem with the Perkins Coie report, I think, is that they couldn't approach anybody. You had to go to them as a survivor and tell your story. And so I think many hundreds, if not thousands of survivors either didn't know or weren't equipped to do that, because it's pretty scary going and talking to a bunch of lawyers and telling them that, you know, 30, 20 years ago when you were young, your doctor was like groping you and doing inappropriate things or raping you. So there's an awful lot of people I've spoken to who are not representative in that report. I think what that report did was it announced that this happened, that it was, you couldn't argue that this had happened. It is fact. So I think it was strong enough in terms of that. You know, it said that there were numerous rapes. It said that people knew, coaches, trainers, administration knew, but it was anonymous. And I think that's very problematic.
You know, I think you made this point, but there are people who say, well, wait a minute, these were big guys. These were big wrestlers. Yeah. And some, you know, puny doctor goes and sexually, why didn't they just, you know, beat the hell out of him? And people, I think, don't fully realize, which your film documents, this guy held tremendous power over these athletes. If he didn't pass them, they lose their scholarship.
They'd lose scholarship and their careers. He had all the power, and they were young, they were naive, they weren't informed. You know, Dan Ritchie says, I didn't know what grooming was. It's a very different time now. And that's one of the things I've always said to the guys. No matter what this film does, if one kid watches this film and either gets out of a situation or speaks up or tells somebody, it was worth speaking out. And I think it's done a lot more than that because a lot of people have been watching this film. You know, in the first, second or third day it was out, it was number one on Max. And I think a lot of people are watching it, a lot of people are talking about it, and the guys are finally getting the respect and the belief that they deserved, that they were sort of robbed of for the last 7 years. And that's where I come back to the guys, and I just think they're so strong. Their families are so strong. I mean, one of the sons of one of the guys in the film, I want to keep it anonymous, I think he was about 15 or 16 when we filmed. And we're in people's houses. I meet the wives. People have to trust you. And I got back to LA and I got a message from a 15 or 16-year-old son of one of the survivors, and it said, thank you for doing this for my family. It means so much to me. And I've done a lot of really tough films. I'm already feeling it now. And I burst into tears, which has never happened to me before. I mean, I've worked with refugees and, you know, I've made films in Afghanistan and in Iran and Lebanon, and I've seen terrible things, and I've done other abuse films. But there's something about this and the men not being believed and heard that is different. And it's, you know, it's just, it's made, it's, I mean, think about it. There's been some of the kids of the survivors it's been half their lives that they've been dealing with their dads going through this. It's just, it's really cruel. It's a very cruel story to the survivors, I think.
Let me ask one more and turn it back to James. Yeah, there are these suits you say won't probably come to court to 26 or 27, but they will come to court. Will Jim Jordan have to testify under oath?
He'll be deposed. You know, in the film we have depositions of Dr. Grace and Dr. Lombardo. That had already been done, so we were lucky to be able to get them. But, top of the list is deposing Russ Hellickson, Jim Jordan. But, you know, the concern is now, I mean, I this is a question, not a statement, but, you know, do people now lie under oath? What do you guys think?
I forget. I didn't know. I mean, whatever a new lie he has to come up with. James?
Yeah, I think I was exactly. I think gonna get a lucky cheat. That was a long time ago. You know, I heard something about it, but yeah, follow up. I mean, it's bullshit. So, before I let you go, so obviously you're a female director. And this is almost an exclusively male story. Do you think being a female were you able to bring a different eye to this, or do you think it was a story no matter what? I mean, let's just talk a little bit about that, because I find that to be fascinating.
I think it's different, honestly, because I'm a woman, and this will make you laugh, but obviously I'm Australian. I've lived in America for 21 years. I'm going to say that I'm a citizen so they don't deport me, because I'm a citizen of America, which won't stop them. But when the story first came to me through the producers and my agents, I said no. I was like, my gut, you know, you go with your gut, you guys know that. And I was like, yes. I don't think I should do this. I'd recently done a film called Bikram for Netflix, which was about the hot yoga guru who abused women. And I honestly, 3.5, 4 years ago, I don't think I knew what OSU was. I certainly had never heard of a Buckeye. I'm the opposite of you guys. I do not watch American sport. And so I thought, this is not for me. And I spoke to John Wertheim. He's become a really great friend and I love. And he said, I think you're the right person. Why don't you talk to a few of the guys? So I spoke to three of them on Zoom. And all three of them said to me in that conversation, wow, I've said things to you that I've never said to anyone else.
That's what I was looking for.
And I thought, oh, shit, there's something in being an outsider, being Australian. I didn't go to college here. I know nothing of college sports. And, I mean, there's a line in the film, I think it's Rocky, and he explains what wrestling is in a couple of sentences. And that's because I'd said to him, Rocky, can you explain wrestling to someone, to like a three-year-old who's not super smart. Like I didn't even know what, I didn't understand wrestling. And it's been a really interesting journey for us. And when I was super nervous showing the film to the guys. I mean, it's been a long process. They've trusted me. They didn't know me. The day before the premiere in Tribeca, HBO were fantastic because I said, I think I need to show it to the guys with their partners. We brought them all to New York, just me and them, and just let them have the emotion and the response without an audience. And then the next day they can watch it with an audience at the premiere. And I sat in the back of the cinema and I was so terrified that, you know, a bunch of big tough wrestlers and me in the back. And I didn't watch the film. I watched them watching the film and they were all crying and it was very emotional. And afterwards I didn't get one, you know, why didn't you do this or why didn't you put this in the film? They got it and they loved it and it changed them and empowered them. And it was kind of, I've been doing this for over 25 years and there's something about this story that's really changed and affected me. So it's kind of full circle, but it's kind of weird that I made this very masculine film as a female who doesn't know anything about this world. It was an interesting choice, I think.
You would say it's a masculine film, I would say it's a human film.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And also, it was really great to have Colleen Marshall, the journalist, and also Charlotte Remniak's daughter in the film, just to give it some female perspective. And what was interesting about that is that, you know, they all come into it knowing and believing and adding that extra layer of believing, because that's been one of the biggest things. And I think, you know, finishing on the fact that Jim Jordan has not said anything, has not come out, the university has been very, very quiet, I think that's hugely problematic. I just hope this film really changes something, but that's optimistic, I think.
Well, let's hope not, because it is the most compelling documentary that I have watched in years. Anybody out there, anybody, you need to watch Surviving Ohio State, HBO and Max. It's a story you'll be outraged, you may cry, you may just be you will be dazzled by what Eva has put together. It is a very, very tragic story, but it's a story that really needs to be told. And let's hope, maybe it's too optimistic, but let's hope that Jim Jordan, Russ Helixson, and the Ohio State University will face some consequences for this, because Eva, you have laid the whole story out there.
Thank you, guys. It's been an honor talking to you. I'm such a big fan.
Eva, again, thank you. It's Surviving Ohio State, HBO Max. You have been a fabulous guest.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, James, our guest, perfect for this Independence Day holiday week, is Joseph Ellis, distinguished professor of history at Mount Holyoke, author of about a dozen books about the founding fathers era, biographies of Washington, Jefferson, Adams, a Pulitzer Prize winning historian. Joe, we are so honored to have you with us. And we're taping this on July 2nd, which was the actual date, as you've taught me, that the Declaration was signed. And I think your curmudgeon-y friend, John Adams, refused to celebrate the 4th.
Well, as you will see at the end of my remarks, that's true. But in the end, first of all, you're right. The proper date should be July 2nd. But in the end, Adams and Jefferson together decided to make it the right date. And I'll tell you how they did that.
They died.
On July 3rd, John Adams wrote to his beloved Abigail saying, "Yesterday, June 30th, will be the day celebrated by future generations of Americans."
July 2nd.
July 2nd. That will be the day there will be marches. There will be eloquence. There will be, for fireworks. He got everything right, even the fireworks. But he got the day wrong, because he thought the day they would celebrate independence is the day they voted on a proposal from the Virginia delegation that read as follows: that these colonies are and have every right to be independent states. That was the key commitment. They were now decisively committed to independence. And at the same time, on the 2nd, the man from Virginia, the representative, whose name was Benjamin Harrison, went up to his colleague from Massachusetts, Elbridge Gerry, who later had the misfortune to have gerrymandering named after him. And he said, "Mr. Gerry, you are an unlucky man, and I am very lucky. I am lucky because I am fat, and you are unlucky because you're skinny. And when they come to hang us, I will die quickly, and you will twist in the wind for a long time." So once again, they all think, all the people at the time think that the decisive moment was the 2nd. And there are reasons that the public gets confused about this later on. I think the biggest source of the confusion is the play 1776. In the play, for dramatic reasons, they change history. At the very end of the film, it shows each of the founders coming up to sign the Declaration. Never happened. Never happened. They were signing the Declaration into August and September. And it's the people that signed last often put their names at the top to make it look like they had signed earlier.
Like they were the earlier birds. Joe, what would those were extraordinary men at Philadelphia.
Oh, God. They're the greatest generation. They are the greatest generation of political leaders. I've got a book coming out. I'm not going to plug it. I'm just going to tell you that it exists.
Plug it.
It's called The Great Contradiction. This is the greatest generation of political leaders in American history. The current leadership of both political parties is not even comparable. I think the greatest generation of Americans, as we know, is the World War II generation that went to war. But this is the greatest generation of political leaders. They won the success.
What would they think of the American experience today?
Oh, boy. Well, because I've read all their papers, I feel that I have the right and the ability to talk to them. And periodically I do. And most recently I told them about the internet and social media. And they all said, "You're screwed." with that in place, democracy takes on the form that we feared. Vulnerability to demigods. We founded a republic, res publica, things of the public. The public is different from the people. The people usually don't know what's in the long-term interest of the republic. Res publica, public things. So, and they actually created in the Senate a 6-year term so that it was more likely, we didn't see this happen yesterday, that senators would do the right thing, even when it was at odds with their own immediate interest. That's what they call virtue.
We've sure forgotten about that, Joe. And you wrote last year that if Donald Trump were president on July 4th, 2026, that there would be a eulogy honoring the collapse of the American Republic. Five months into his regime.
I think I wrote a piece for the LA Times saying that. Yeah.
And are you as pessimistic as you were then?
Yes. Although I think it's a sense of irony, and I'll expand on this, that it's in the year that we're beginning to celebrate the 250th anniversary of American independence, the current occupant of the White House regards himself as the second coming of George III. Mm-hmm. And if I was teaching a seminar on this at, say, Mount Holyoke or Amherst or Williams, where I also taught, I would divide the class into two groups. One group would read the early section, the most famous section, the one that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." The other would read the second section, the longer section, which very few Americans ever read, but it was the section that the delegates at the time thought was most important because they were breaking with George III, the final link to the British Empire. It was written by Jefferson, and he was like a prosecuting attorney. And I think all of our listeners should go back and read both sections. For the first section, I want them to ask the question to themselves. If you take that first section clearly, is the American Revolution over? And the answer is no. The full promise of the American Revolution has not been fulfilled. If you read the second section, much longer, much more difficult, what you're going to discover is between 6 and 12 charges against George III that apply perfectly and equally to the current resident of the White House. In other words, what's the movement that came up recently, No King, which drew huge thousands and millions of people? The young men and women that organized that were very historically informed. Thank God for them. But that effectively, the second part of the Declaration, I want you to read that and see and have a dialogue among your neighbors and friends. What does that mean? It really does mean that we have that the current occupant of the White House, Donald Trump, is, what do you want to call him, a king, and or regards himself as such. And the members of the Supreme Court seem to be willing to at least partially support that perception. And this is an abandonment of the core values of the founding, which is happening just as we celebrate the creation of those values.
Well, James.
So, Prof, if I remember this correctly, didn't Jefferson and Adams die on July 4th, 1824, the same day? Is that
26.
Is my memory correct on that?
You are looking right ahead to my final words here, and you got it exactly right, James.
Okay.
On July 4th, 50 years later, 1826, Thomas Jefferson died at 12:10 p.m. His last words were, "Is it the fourth?" Jefferson died a bit later at 4:00. His last words were, "Thomas Jefferson still lives." And Adams, that there are several other founders, to include Madison, Monroe, who tried to die on schedule too. Madison missed by 3 days. Monroe missed by 2 days. These guys really seem to be committed to dying on schedule. And that schedule is the fourth. And therefore, Joe Ellis says, even though it turned out to be, it was not historically right, it becomes historically right 50 years later. And we can feel okay when the fireworks go off on the fourth, because at least the two of the most prominent founders have come to accept it as the proper date.
So, Prof, I had a journey, and a guy that I want to talk about is the obvious guy, but it's George Washington. So I kind of grew up, he didn't cut the myth, and was kind of taught, well, he was a great man, but he wasn't that great a general, et cetera, et cetera. I think Washington was a pretty damn good general during the Revolutionary War. I mean, he held that ragtag bunch of people.
He was.
Pretty good.
I think I agree with you, James, and he lost more battles than he won. He's one of the greatest generals in the world, and certainly in American history. But he was outmaneuvered by his opponents, usually by simple flanking movements. But he was also commanding a group of untrained militia who couldn't go equal to the British Army in the early stages of the war. But Ellis says there are six great founders. There's Washington. There's Franklin, who's the wisest. There's Jefferson, who's the most intellectually sophisticated. There's Adams, who's the most honest and the best read in the classics. There is Hamilton, who's the smartest, who would have got the highest grade on the SATs. And there's Madison, who was the greatest political player. If God were in the details, Madison would be there to greet him upon arrival. But all of them agreed that Washington was the greatest. And why? Well, there are two big foundings. One is when we declare independence and win the war. And secondly, when we declare nationhood 10 years, 11 years later, the Constitution, he's a major player there. And if you want to know what the powers of the presidency are, I challenge you to look at the Constitution and try and define it. It's very unclear. The only thing that's clear is they don't want the president to be a king. But the powers of the presidency are defined by Washington's two terms. He is a powerful symbolic figure and a prime minister at the same time. So when I was on the panel for the American Historical Association for 12 years voting on who is the greatest president, the top three are always the same. Chronologically, they're Washington, Lincoln, and FDR. Roosevelt comes in next. I always put Washington first, but Lincoln seems to be the current choice. And when you're judging Washington, I'm thinking Washington created the republic that Lincoln saved. But in addition, in this book that I wrote recently that we're not trying to plug.
No.
What's the title of it again, Joe? I know
we're not plugging.
The title of it is The Great Contradiction, The Tragic Side of the American Founding.
Okay, The Great Contradiction by Joe Ellis, but we're not plugging it. But go ahead, Joe.
We are not plugging it. Although the people at Random House would be thrilled if we do. That one of the big failures, there are two big failures. The failure to end slavery in the South. They did end slavery in all the northern states, okay? The people that are on that 1776 movement get that wrong. They end slavery in all the states north of the Chesapeake, but they don't end it in the states where 90% of the slaves live. Washington is the only prominent slave owner who frees his slaves. He frees him in his will. You want him to do it earlier, but he doesn't. And in effect, because Washington, in his first term, nobody knows this. You'll know your readers. It's in the Jefferson papers. It's unlikely, but when he just was elected president, he called his cabinet together. Just as they were getting to leave, he said, "Oh, by the way, I want you all to know that if the current sectional conflict, becomes a civil war, I will side with the North." As soon as he said that, Jefferson went back to Virginia and spread the word Jefferson was a traitor, and Mount Vernon was a Trojan horse buried in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Not only that, but Washington made a truly heroic effort to avoid Indian removal. They passed a treaty, somebody needs to make a movie about this, called the Treaty of New York. He gathered together 38 Indians from the Creek tribe with their head guy, a guy called Alexander McGillifray. Whoever plays him in the movie is going to win an Oscar. And they established the rule that no Indian land could be taken from them without their consent, and that the land of the Cherokee Nation was now theirs, and they were a separate state. The land that was given to them is the current state of Mississippi and half the state what's right next to Mississippi?
Louisiana, Alabama, or Arkansas, Tennessee?
My wife is from this state.
Mississippi.
Yeah, it's Mississippi. And that land is theirs. And eventually, over time, it will come into the Union as a state of its own. That's what Washington tried to do. And he said it was the greatest commitment of his presidency. He cared most about it. And it failed. And it failed because you couldn't stop the flow of whites from Georgia coming across and just flooding and pursuing their happiness for land. They simply lacked the resources to do that. It would have taken an army of about 20,000 to stop it. The current size of the Continental Army was 4,000. So Washington went to his grave regretting this failure, but that he's the only person, prominent Virginian, to free his own slaves. And he took a leadership role in the other great failure of our founding generation to avoid Indian removal. That's why he's the greatest. But your instincts on this are correct. But here's a little thing. I'm going to give a talk down at Mount Vernon later in the year. And I'm going to say to him, you know, if Washington was looking down, he wouldn't want us to be here. What do I mean? Washington, in his will, did another thing other than freeing his slaves. He divided his estate into 5 or 6 different units. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to leave the estate to your senior ancestor so it can be kept intact. He wanted Mount Vernon to gradually disappear. Why did he want that? Because he knew that Mount Vernon was the place. At the time of his death, there were 417 slaves at Mount Vernon that was connected to slavery. And if his reputation was viewed through the prism of slavery, it would be a major problem. And so it didn't disappear because this group called the Ladies of Mount Vernon in 1860, and they were all wives of Southern slave owners, bought Mount Vernon and reconstructed it. Washington did not believe that when he died, he was going anywhere but into the ground, what he called the mansion of my fathers. He didn't believe in Christian notion of life after death. He did believe that he could live on in the memory of subsequent generations. That was the only realistic form of immortality. And that he needed to remove that slavery from that memory. But he didn't do it. Nevertheless, and I think that he would want you to go to the Washington Monument. It's got, by the way, the Washington Monument is not only the tallest building in Washington, named after him, of course, city. It's one of the few that has no words on it. There are no words. It's a monument to a monument. But all that said, back to the original, I think he's the greatest leader in American history.
So I have one more question. We'll turn it back to Al. Very early, I wrote about that in the New York Times, saying the Democrats should play possum, should rope-a-dope, don't confront immediately. A large part of inspiration of that prop was Washington at Long Island in New York. The British came, as I recall, please correct me if I've got this story wrong, the British come ashore pretty powerfully in Long Island.
Yep.
And Washington gets the hell out of there and escapes New York under fog and night.
That's right. Got it. You got it.
I mean, we won the fucking war because if we would have not retreated, as much as people hate that, Colville wants to retreat, Colville wants to give up. No, I don't want to do that anymore. George Washington wanted to give up.
I'm writing a piece on this. You got it, James, you got it right. And it's a big deal. 32,000 right. British troops landed on Long Island, the biggest trip across the Atlantic ever until Americans go the other way in World War I. They have to crush this rebellion in the cradle. Washington makes the big mistake under the orders from Congress to try to defend New York. New York is an archipelago. Whoever controls the sea controls the battle. It was a stupid mistake. and they got him trapped. All of his armies trapped. And if you want to believe in miracles, this is one of them. I'm going to write a book called Remembering Lost Stories from the Founding, and this is going to be called The Great Escape. That they're trapped, and Washington decides that he's going to try to escape across the Hudson. And he got these people coming down from Massachusetts who are great naval people to do it. It has to happen. Everything has to happen. The tidal currents have to change. The British Navy has to unexplainably not be present in the river. Clouds have to form around, a mist has to form around the American units who are still on the ground so that the British can't see them escaping. And they have to get across, across the river safely. And they do. And if they hadn't, they would have captured the entire American army to include Washington. And you're right. I've written to seven other historians when I was originally writing about this. And what would have happened if the British captured the entire American army and Washington? Five of them said, it's okay, we would have just raised another army. They quoted a letter from Abigail, which is a great letter at this time. When she finds out the defeat has happened, she says, don't worry, an army of Amazons will win the war for us. But they all agreed that we could have recovered the army, but we could not have recovered Washington. Maybe Nathanael Greene could have replaced him, but he would have been captured too. So if there was ever a chance for the British to win the war, that was it. And once they missed it, it would never come again. And wow. So learning about that is, and again, there's a film coming out by a former student of mine at Yale who is a prominent writer. What's the name of the net thing? It's called The American Miracle. And he was what you might call an evangelical Jew. And he believes that God came down and saved us. And at the end of the war, when Washington was asked right after Yorktown, he said, well, who's going to write the history of the war? And he said, anybody who writes a true history of the war will be accused of writing fiction. Because nobody will believe that things happened the way they did. And so I'm not a believer in the same sense that Michael Medved is, my former student. But if you look at the war, there are so many times in it when, and this one you mentioned is the biggest of all, God takes care of women and children in the United States of America.
Boy, well, Joe, this has been so wonderful. It's been a great history lesson for us. Let me ask you one contemporary issue. I believe you actually taught at West Point for a couple of years.
Three years, right?
This administration is now banning books at Annapolis and at West Point. You're an historian.
Right.
What do you think?
I knew it was Annapolis. I didn't know it was West Point, too.
Yeah, they're doing it West Point also. As a matter of fact, one of the professors resigned because of it.
Yeah, a lot of the guys I knew would have resigned. This was still when the Vietnam War was still going on. Six of my colleagues, and by the way, in my department at West Point, there were six Rhodes Scholars and four Medal of Honor winners. Mm. And they came to me and they said, there was My Lai happened and they were covering it up and the guy that covered it up was commandant at West Point and they wanted him fired. They wouldn't fire him. They said, we made a deal with 60 Minutes. We're going on 60 Minutes. We're all going to resign our commissions. And we want you to come with us. And I said, guys, listen, you got a lot to lose. I'm not a professional soldier. And they said, yeah, but you're the best bullshit artist we got. So it never happened because the guy stepped down. But back then, the men in the West Point were willing to risk everything, including their careers. Not sure that's true now, but I do think that the notion that certain books at West Point, and this is true now in Virginia and Florida, where we're doing all kinds of crazy stuff, I imagine that some people resigned on this, but because they get their money from the federal government, I think they might have been reluctant to say so. One of the things that also happened is that Nixon was threatening to build a monument to Robert E. Lee on the grounds of West Point. And I had all the black cadets come to me, because I was teaching a course in black history there at the time, first one. And they said, we're going to resign our commission if this happens. I said, don't do it. They're going to tie this up so much red tape, it's never going to happen. So it never did happen. And Robert E. Lee was a traitor. Robert E. Lee, sided with the Confederacy. And so there is no monument to nor picture of Robert E. Lee at West Point. And I admire those guys. And let's hope I got no answer to the problem of the books.
Joe, James says this. I spent about 3 or 4 days at West Point some years ago, and I was so impressed I wrote a separate piece on the 10 greatest West Point graduates. Lee was not included because he was a traitor.
Right.
And one and two were Eisenhower and Grant.
That's a good choice.
Listen, you have been wonderful. Joe Ellis is writing a book that we're not going to plug. It's called The Great Contradiction. So I don't want, if anybody out there hears this, it's called The Great Contradiction by Joe Ellis, but we're not plugging it.
That is correct.
Joe, a happy July 2nd and a happy July 4th to you and your family.
Your wife too. And James, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
I ask you a question before we leave. You're famous for the phrase, it's the economy is stupid. And I resisted using the phrase for this, it's the July 2nd stupid.
Well, anything is a compliment, Prof. It just
I'm thinking, based on the decision made by the Senate yesterday and soon to be made possibly by the House with regard to the big great bill for billionaires, do you agree with the following? When the other side is committing suicide, don't interfere.
Completely agree.
Completely agree.
And I'm going to do a video, but go to Gettysburg and talk about how history informs political strategy. And Long Island is going to be a part of that. The falling back on the first day to the fish hook is going to be a real part of that. I think aggression has its own place, but it's not always the right answer to everything. I've just come to learn that. And I think history has so much to teach us.
I worry because in the secondary schools and the middle schools, history had gotten replaced 20 or 30 years ago by something called social studies, which is a smorgasbord of nothing. And history enrollments are down throughout the higher education because all the money's going to the sciences. And also, colleges have priced themselves out of the middle class.
It's like
crazy. It's crazy. I could afford to pay my way at William & Mary by running swimming pools in the summer. Now, I mean, some of the colleges are over $100,000 a year.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
They price them. It's like we have one of the most uneducated electorates in the world. Like only 20% of our electorate is college educated. And only 10% could pass the civics test required of all immigrants. That's how Trump wins elections. I think that higher education, this cannot continue. And in terms of the cost, and I don't know how it's going to play out, but history needs to come back. And historians have a responsibility here to bring us together in terms of understanding the past. And there are some lessons from the founding that we've talked about here today that have direct consequence on our decisions being made now.
Well, if you believe in history, you have to go get The Great Contradiction by Joe Ellis. Now, we're not going to plug it, but it's called again, The Great Contradiction by Joe Ellis.
We're not going
to
plug
it. We want to have you, we'll have you back on when there's a time to plug. When it's time to plug, we'll plug it.
Hey, Joe, you're great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now for the outrage of the week. You know, the best way to deal with a bully is to stand up to a bully. Unfortunately, that's not what Paramount is doing in settling a completely frivolous suit that Trump brought because he didn't like the way CBS 60 Minutes edited an interview with Kamala Harris last fall. What the hell business is it of a politician of how a news organization edits an interview to fit time or space? There's no way Trump could have won this suit. But Paramount caved and donated $16 million for fees and to any future Trump library. Why? Trump's lackey at the FCC, Brandon Carr, was threatening to hold up a lucrative Paramount merger. So these executives decided that big money was worth a lot more than the reputation of 60 Minutes, the gold standard of commercial television. ABC Disney earlier did the same thing, as did some big New York law firms, who Trump went after because he didn't like some of the lawyers in their firms. Something for all these cowards to remember. This is part of their legacy and will be in their obituaries someday. By contrast, some major law firms, Wilmer Hale, Perkins Coie, Jenner and Black, Sussman Godfrey, stood up to the bully in the Oval Office, and they're prevailing. So did Ann Selzer and the Des Moines Register, which Trump sued because a poll was wrong. There's no more respected pollster, by the way, in America than Ann Selzer. And the big bully is now seeking to move that suit, the Selzer suit, from federal court, where he's losing, to state courts, where he's going to lose also. At some point, somebody should countersue and try to hold the big bully accountable.
Yeah, and it's, you know, they have this corporate ownership, and they shake them down, they get shaken down, and they just give them a check for $16 million.
Yep.
So for my outrage, you know, a lot of hatred goes on in today's America. Not all of it is headline stuff. Some of it is very quotidian. It's very day-to-day. I read an article from the newspaper in New Orleans because I just thought this was particularly outrageous. A longtime music teacher and band director at a Catholic school in Metairie, the best where Amy Coney Barrett's from, contends that he was fired this week after a parent complained about his same-sex marriage, sparking an outcry from some parents, students, and alum. Mark Richards, who began teaching at St. Francis Xavier School in 2003, had helped the K-8 school establish a successful band program, and he was let go on Wednesday after a parent brought his late husband's obituary from 2023 to the attention of archdiocesan officials and school administrators. Though the obituary names Richard as the man's surviving spouse, okay? You understand this. This guy died, his partner died in 2003. 2 years later, this hag decides that she's going to take it to the archdiocese to get him fired. The archdiocese in New Orleans, which is desperately trying to pay hundreds of millions off for pedophilia and child abuse and everything else, says, well, we can't have him a teacher because he violates the morals clause. God damn, man, how cruel and petty and small can people be? That just un-fucking believable. This guy, over 20 years, teaches these kids music, establishes a program, is apparently very good at what he does. And the archdiocese and you all is going to let you go because you gay? Oh, my God. The hypocrisy is just breathtaking. Just breathtaking. It is breathtaking.
It is.
Breathtaking.
Totally. And it's, James, you are from a great state. But there have been some hypocrites. I noticed that Jimmy Swaggart just died.
Yeah,
he was evangelical.
You know, I'll say something about Swaggart. Musically, he is one of the most talented people you can imagine. He is probably the greatest gospel singer of all time. he was from Faraday, as were Mickey Gilley and Jerry Lee Lewis. They were all grew up in the same place, right. And they were related.
They were related.
And, you know, there are people that say, maybe, you know, and Spigot, when he got called, got the whole story about him and the motel and the prostitute. And and the guy was, he made a fortune at one time. I mean, he was a charlatan, but he was good. You should listen to him sing some of these gospel songs. He was really fucking talented, but boy, was he, yep, he was God-headed.
Okay. All right, now we have what are just better and better every week questions from our listeners. And again, if we don't get to yours this week, please write back and we'll try to get to it next week. Barry in Saskatoon, Canada. James wants to know, how can the Republicans cry over the way ICE agents are being treated when they didn't give a damn about the way the police who were protecting the Capitol on January 6th were mauled?
You know, it's a very good observation. And you know what I'm going to do is your idea, my dear friend from Saskatoon, which is in Saskatchewan, which is anytime that Canada used to be on jeopardy, a friend of mine used to say, Saskatchewan. But I'm officially putting you on notification. I'm going to steal that thought. I'm going to steal that thought.
Run with it. Right.
And I'm probably not going to give credit to my listener in Saskatchewan. I'm just going to steal it. Great, great point. I wish I'd have thought of it myself.
Okay, Barry, we'll give you credit, though. Next, Terry in Des Arc, Missouri. It's DESARK. I assume that's Des Arc. I don't know where it is, but we can find out.
I don't either. I'll look it up.
Dr. Terry says, winning message. He asks this question. Fix the Supreme Court, make the economy work for the middle class, and fight global warming. Simple thoughts. Yes, sort of, Terry, and I don't want to ignore the Supreme Court. They're awful, or ignore global warming, which is an existential threat. But the short term focus 80% on the gift the Republicans have just given you, that incredibly regressive, unfair, and dangerous big, not so beautiful bill.
I agree with you. I'm obviously a very informed listener. And there's so much to deal with, and we gotta pick our spots. And I think the big beautiful bill is right in front of it. Now, by the way, a lot of environmental stuff in there. It's just is a lot of things you're talking about are in that big beautiful bill. A way to talk about it, but it does give us a lot of leverage. A lot.
Sure does. John in Sonoma, California. I think we hear from our dear friend in Sonoma frequently because he always asks good questions. John wants you, James, to talk him off the ledge. Are Trump and MAGA essentially announcing there will be no elections in the U.S. after passing the big, beautiful bill, as it's massively unpopular and will probably cause them to lose the Senate in 2026? So they're going to go after try to cancel the elections.
Well, I'm not going to talk you off the ledge because you have every reason to be on the ledge. I'm going to say don't jump just yet, but I understand it. I don't think you're overblown the situation. When Virginia comes in, this is what I think is going to happen. I think Virginia and Jersey are going to come in. They're going to be more than substantial wins. Virginia's going to be really substantial. He's going to see the polling is going to be very discouraging. He's bad right now. It's really bad for him right now. It's going to get worse. And he's going to try to do something. I don't think he'll succeed, but I don't know that. One thing that people say that I want to address, people say, I'm scared he's going to try to run for a third term. If that guy tried to run for the third term, I'd hold his coat. I'd say, don't worry about the Constitution. Let him go. I would give anything for him to run for a third term. But outside of that, I think your fears are justified. I think we need to be vigilant. I think he's going to absolutely this time next year, when he sees what happened in Virginia and New Jersey, sees what's going to happen, you know, in a lot of other places. He's going to see the polls. The people are going to come in. He's going to try something. I promise you. He's going to try something.
Yeah. You know he'd do it if he could get away with it. There is no question. I think you raise a very disturbing but good point, John. Bob in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, says, even if we could blink our eyes and win the majority in the Senate and the House, why do we think it would make a difference? Bob, it would make a difference in the sense that, Trump couldn't get through bad legislation if that were to happen. There would be very important investigations that would be held in the Senate. There would be very few confirmations, particularly to the courts, because it's a return the favors that they tried to inflict upon Democrats. So I think it does make a huge difference. Having said that, it's not going to stop Trump, because he doesn't believe in the rule of law. Everything he has done to date, don't forget that big, beautiful bill hadn't passed yet, thank God, but I'm afraid it will. But everything he's done, all the awful stuff he's done, has been done without legislative authority. So I think it's incredibly important for Democrats to win the House and hopefully the Senate in 2026. But it's not going to really tame Trump, and I don't think that Supreme Court is going to stop him much.
Okay, I'm going to make a couple of points about the importance of winning. First of all, the importance of winning the Senate, which I think I speak for you, is, I don't know if it's 50-50, but it's better than most all the prognosticators are saying
We
definitely have a chance of that. What that will stop is him appointing a Supreme Court justice, which is huge. Mm-hmm. Huge. Because they have all the reason in the world. Mitch McConnell laid the president down. There's no reason that if the Democrats control the Senate that they would obligated to confirm a Trump Supreme Court nominee. That's number one. All right. Number two is when you're able to do this, you can force them to vote and you can force him to veto. Or he'll veto this stuff. Don't get me wrong. But every time you do that, it re-energizes, it focuses people. Number three, the bigger majority that you have going into 28, and 26 is going to be a good year, but I think 28 will, but I'm not sure. Is you're going to, the next Democratic president, the more majority you have in the Congress, the better off you are. It only makes sense. So you want to win as many elections as you possibly can in 26, because it can stop something catastrophic in the Supreme Court. It can continue to bring repeated attention to his catastrophic, big, beautiful bill. And you want to build up a majority, so when you're inevitably going to lose some seats, you'll keep some and you'll keep for a long time. So there's a lot of good reasons to be energetic and concerned and fighting hard for 2026.
Yeah, I totally agree. We got good questions from John, wherever they live. We had Sonoma earlier. This is John in Chicago. James, he wants to say, it's a good question. Is it harder for Democrats to have a cohesive messaging and plans because we're such a broad and diverse coalition? We're not a small faction of angry white religious zealots. We have different culture, backgrounds, and ideologies. Does that make it tougher for us to have a coherent message?
Brilliant question and a brilliant observation. Yep. We are part of a coalition. And I always tell people, if you're in a coalition and you're comfortable, you're not in a coalition. They're not in a, there's no such thing as conservatism, okay? They're in a personality cult. And the nature of a Democrat is we don't want to be in a personality cult. But what I'm saying pretty cleanly here is the coalition has to hang together through the 2026 elections. I don't have any illusions that the coalition is going to have its problems going forward in 2028, but that's the way it should, and Democrats are going to have to start out what part of the coalition that we want to elevate and run with. But that's a decision that's going to be made after the 2026 elections. For now, we got to hold the coalition together as much as we possibly can to win as many seats as we can. But you're right, it is being in a coalition is difficult.
It is. It also makes it, I think, a more representative party, but it does present, serious challenges. Charlie in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Lackawanna County.
Exactly. Said, is it time that Democrats finally ask questions like, if my Republican friends here are so anti-socialist, are they ready to call for an end to police, fire departments, libraries, etc.? Charlie, I'd add one more. the National Football League. What happens with the National Football League? The worst team gets to draft first and gets the best pick. And there are caps on what everybody can spend. I mean, you know, if you're an economist, you'd say that's certainly a form of socialism. Look, it's such a misused term. I think some Republicans realize it, because I noticed that Trump and Elise Stefanik, who will stoop at I'm not going to go there, are calling the Democratic winner or the New York primary a communist now. So they kind of figure, I guess, that socialist doesn't quite resonate the way it did before. So he's a communist, which, of course, is total bullshit. But that's what they are. James.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, if you want to see kind of socialism, but they also have capitalism. I think they can exist side by side. If you don't believe me, go to Denmark, Sweden, Finland, and Norway. And what you're not going to see is poverty. What you're not going to see is people being broke because of healthcare expenses. And what you're going to see is a damn vibrant and competitive private sector. So I think this is idiotic that your choice is unrestrained capitalism and being the political system of North Korea. And that's a false choice.
Yeah,
false choice.
James, Paul in Rochester, Minnesota, home of the Mayo Clinic, asked, why is Fox not subject to constant criticism from other network media?
Yep, I'll let you answer that because you're more inbred in media culture. Usually, the media doesn't like to attack other people. I don't know if that's true, but Fox. But I don't know. There's been books and articles. I think Fox gets a lot of attention from the mainstream media. I mean, you pretty much know what's going on. And remember, this huge lawsuit cost them $750 million, and there's more to come. So I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure I totally agree with the premise.
Yeah, I agree, Paul. It's not going to make any difference. Unfortunately, they are very clever and very successful and very disingenuous. But I'll tell you this, if they ever got their way, if the right wing ever got their way and they wanted to really curb press freedoms, do away with Times v. Sullivan, the famous 64 case, Fox would suffer. Because Fox, I think there's far more defamatory stuff on Fox than there is on other places that I watch. But I don't think criticism from other media will much matter.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, they would thrive on it. They'll have nothing better. If you think of the New York Times criticized Fox, they would love that. They'd run that 50 times a day.
The other thing is
you and I, we've assigned students to look at Fox and other networks, and they all come back with the same thing. They make better television than MSNBC.
It's just good. It's irresponsible. You know, it's inaccurate, but goddamn, it's good television. You're right. Well, listen, please keep those questions coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. And a happy 4th of July to everybody. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Fay Nutrition, in the episode show notes. We really thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. And when you go to the episode show notes, don't forget to vote for the worst of the worst Trump appointees. There's a link right there. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. And remember to go over the show notes again. I want to remind you this for the third time and vote on the worst of the worst in the Trump administration. Speak up while you can. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.